Hi there, welcome to it. This is episode 98 of the Planet LP Podcast. I'm Ted Asvergadu. A couple of weeks ago, I was thinking about a time when I was between 18 and 20 years old. Now, this was decades ago. It was a time I had a part-time job. I was at my local community college. I was taking classes to transfer to a four-year university. And I was pretty deep. I mean, more than knee-deep, probably neck-deep in my music addiction. It was pretty strong. I was going to the record store maybe 2-3 times a week to buy one or two records. Now, back then, when an artist or a band released an album, and I'm talking a major label release, those labels had to build excitement around the new record, so they'd release a single a couple months before the album came out. Radio and MTV got on board. They started spinning the single, or MTV started playing the video. It would go up the charts, the music press would run interviews, and maybe there would be secret shows to road test the new material. The band would make a big announcement about the tour, and if the label had the budget, they would spring for TV commercials to get people even more excited about the record and when it debuted. The overall goal, of course, was to get people like me to go down to the record store and buy the record. Now, that was the marketing campaign, and those marketing campaigns work like most marketing campaigns. They had a call to action, and that call to action was to tell folks like me, hey, get your lazy butt off the couch, grab your wallet, and head down to the record store and buy this new album. Did it always work? No, not always, but it worked well enough that if a label thought they had something really special, i.e. the big suits would say, I think this album's going to move units, they'd spend some cash on the promotion and marketing campaign. That was then, and this is now. And now, there's a lot of do-it-yourself marketing for musicians. Social media seems to exist not to connect people so much with their friends, but to sell things. It makes for a crowded field. So how do you stand out? How do you build excitement around an album release where the work and all the time and money you spent creating it is now viewed by consumers and music fans as essentially a free commodity? So if you have a streaming service, there's no need to get your butt anywhere. You just grab your phone and open an app and the new album is there for you to listen to. There's no friction, no additional payment necessary, no nothing stopping you from hearing what's new from your favorite artists? Well, now we have Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift is actually very good about marketing her new albums. She has a team around her that knows how to leverage the current landscape to create excitement and build momentum about her album releases. It usually starts with an announcement. In this case, it was during the Eras tour. And then the social media posts start up with some Easter eggs. And this is to get her fans who have like a QAnon obsession about her. They start speculating about what's next. Then they create a big teaser video full of more Easter eggs. And they even partnered with Spotify, the streaming service, to put an art installation in Los Angeles. It had lyrics to the songs on the new album, which were written in books shelved in a small library. The idea being is that fans would show up to this installation, take some pictures, and post it on social media. Of course, the press writes about her, TV covers her, radio still plays plenty of her music, so in a way, legacy media is still important in her marketing campaign. So some of the elements that were in place 40 years ago are still being used. It's all to get people excited about the record. So for Taylor fans, the buildup, the momentum to the release of the Tortured Poets Department came on April 19th at midnight. That's when the album dropped. But it didn't really drop so much as appear on your phones or your streaming feeds. It's just kind of there. But streaming doesn't pay all that much revenue, so how does Taylor and her marketing people get folks, really fans, to buy the physical copy of the record? They make different versions that come with extra goodies. Just go online, plunk down your credit card, and you'll get the product at some point. So once this debut happens, it's off to the races to see how many streams she can get, how many albums she can sell, how many views on YouTube she can get. Now the frenzy is going to wane, as it always does. But you can't deny that Taylor is one of a few artists who can still get people excited about the release of a new album in an age where that excitement doesn't happen all that often. To talk about the new Taylor album, Keith Creighton is here. Keith is a Pop Dose writer and a frequent contributor to the Planet LP podcast. We're going to talk about Taylor Swift's album, The Tortured Poets Department. It's only been out for one day as of this recording, so there's a lot to absorb. 31 songs, over 2 hours of music. It's like going to the movies these days. So let's get right to it, shall we? Welcome back to the pod. Glad to have you back on. It's been a bit, hasn't it?
Really? And I want to wish you a happy Taylor Swift Day, you know, celebrated around the world.
Yes. Yes, it is. I didn't get you a card, but I tried to write something on a typewriter, but then I realized I don't have a typewriter, so I couldn't do that. But here we are talking about a record that just got released on April 19th. We are recording this on National Pot Day, which is 420. It's a little early, perhaps, in talking about Taylor Swift's new record, The Tortured Poets Department, or as I sometimes call it, the Dead Poets Society. But Keith, were you able to listen to the entire record? Now we're talking about two albums worth of music now.
When they first announced that there was going to be a deluxe edition on TaylorSwift.com, I bought it thinking, oh, I'm going to get this because they said it was only going to be available for a week. Little did I know that then there will be a different deluxe edition the next week, and then a third one and a fourth one. I'm like, oh my God, I'm an idiot for buying. Like, you know, it's like you invest in the market at the wrong time. And that thing still hasn't come yet. And from what I could tell, I forget what was all in it, but I mean, there's everything in there. I think there's trading cards, photographs, a lyric sheet, some kind of poem, maybe a can opener. I have no idea what else is in this like super deluxe pack that's coming.
Can I ask you how much you paid for it?
So here's the thing. I was all in for $29 after shipping, because I think it was $17.99. Wow. And then you had the shipping on. So I was already in for $29 when all of a sudden at 2 a.m. they announced that there's the anthology version. And then, you know me, that's one of the things we talk about. I'm a collector. Mm-hmm. I like to have everything in high fidelity, high resolution. And so the second it went on sale on hdtracks.com, I had a coupon code. So they had it for $26.98. And I bought it for $20 because I had a 25% code. So now I'm all in for $50. Then later last night, TaylorSwift.com then says, oh, we're offering the entire deluxe digital, all 31 tracks for $14.99. So I could have saved $5.
Yeah.
But yes, I did have the chance to listen to all 31 tracks several times. I was able to process it all.
Really?
It was interesting that the whole way they market this album was through Easter eggs.
Yeah.
You know, so whether it was her pop-up display at the Grove, all these really strange websites, all the clues that she gave in little speeches and social media posts. And I noticed that you and I were talking in the pre-show banter, which should be its own podcast in itself, you know, that your daughter had a deeper reaction to it. And so did Will Harris, our Pop Dose colleague.
Oh, and right.
Okay. So he writes for Q, the magazine, and his daughter co-wrote an entire piece where she got way more out of this album than I did. Yeah, okay. Like she was able to put all the yarn strings together on the big corkboard. And, you know, I guess they have longstanding theories about the meanings of track fives on Taylor's different studio albums. She talked about the legacy of the track five. She talked about all the characters that she was talking about. And I'm like, wow, you got a lot out of this. Where to me, I get where Taylor is at this point in her career. Her songs aren't as much songs that are going to be around like Fleetwood Mac's Rumors in 50 years, where we're going to be talking about these universal songs of love and heartbreak and redemption. These are really pretty much content. Diary entries, log entries. Maybe it's almost like they put the mic in a confessional at church. You know, or maybe it's a poem or a short story. This is content that's engaging people in the now. And I'm not sure where we're going to be with this particular album in 30 years.
Good point. Because will it really matter about her relationship with, what was his name, Joe Alwyn or something like that? And then Matty Healy from the 1975. In 30 years' time, is that going to matter? You remember Matty Healy? And then people who are 30 years younger are going to go, who?
Exactly. Because she is giving such a raw, deep, analysis into her psyche and where she is right now. She's talking about all these relationships that she's had. She's even mentioning the Travis Kelce years. It's going to depend on where Taylor Swift stands with the test of time, whether we even care about, oh, let's go back and revisit where she was in the year 2024. Because if, yeah, people still love her in 20 years, then yeah, it's going to be like, oh, it's like, you know, going into history and remembering where she was back then. Versus imagine if she blows her legacy. Like there was a little bit of a kerfuffle, you know, yesterday when people analyzed the lyrics about wanting to live in 1830 again. People are like, wait a minute, that was the height of slavery. That was pre-Civil War, the whole nine yards. Where Taylor Swift was, she was talking about, it was so much easier back then. She just got married off to a man. You know, she didn't have to go through courtship and all that kind of stuff because, and I wanted to bring this up, you, Ted, have something that Taylor Swift wants and would probably trade her entire career for. Do you know what that is?
A Scion XB?
Well, I forgot we both have Scion XBs.
Yes, we do. Yeah.
Well, second to the Scion XB, which is a really reliable car, and really cute, is you have a marriage. You have lasting relationship. How long have you been married now?
30 years.
There you go. Yeah. You know, because that's the one thing, that's the narrative thread that ties us all together from Taylor Swift's self-titled debut album all the way through now, is she has longed for that relationship. She has longed for a solid man to step up and want to marry her and spend the rest of her life with her. She dreams about pushing strollers around the park and all that, but that's the one thing that has eluded her. Then that's given her, yes, you know, 11 full albums of songs to talk about, but it's the one thing that is the kind of the melancholy undercurrent of all of this stuff, is her inability to find the right partner and then to step up. And you know, you've been married for 30 years. I was only married for 7. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of work, not only to get a relationship to that level, but then to maintain that relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. Money doesn't buy happiness, is what you're saying. Money, fame, fortune, all of that, people obsessing about you. It still doesn't buy that what you really want or what she would really like in life. And that is to have a man in her life that's a stable presence and one that she can grow old with and have children with and just have a life that's separate in many ways from the fame that she's experiencing. Very difficult when you're in that position, because the type of men that you're going to meet, as she has throughout her life, are men who are very much in her league, as in they have a lot of star power. They've done similar things to get to where they are in their careers. They're not the most stable people because they're very focused on themselves, about my career, myself, getting to a certain level, maintaining that, and if not exceeding that. That's a hard thing to do. And then you want this other life. If in that alternate universe she had that other life, would she be pining away for the life that she has now? I could have been something. I used to write songs. I used to think about screenplays in my head, and I love fashion or whatever. Yeah. And you're in this marriage that may be stable, but you may have traded the stability for something that you think in that stable universe, this other thing would have made you really happy. So there's just really no winning, right? You can't go through the alternate universes and say, well, it looks like alternate universe number 5 was the best. I think I'll live that life.
Yeah. And there is a big ominous weight of the specter of Ethan Hawke that's going to go through our conversation today, and especially with this album. But you bring up something where pre-divorce, Uma Thurman and Ethan Hawke talked about how hard it is for two people at the top of their game in entertainment careers to maintain a marriage, because one of them has to put their career on hold to be with the other one, let's say during a 3-month film shoot, you know? And so that was the thing where they were coming to the end of their marriage because neither of them wanted to curb their career and to give up A-list projects in order to be with the other person. But then when you're stuck on spending most of your year on 3 to 5 month film shoots without the partner there, how does the marriage kind of sustain?
Yeah,
so that's the first. We'll start tracking the Ethan Hawke references throughout this, because I watched earlier in the week the Brittany Murphy documentary on HBO. And I was thinking about that then throughout listening to the Tortured Poets Department, because Brittany Murphy became a star very, very young. ascended to the height of her career in terms where she was leading major Hollywood romantic comedies. But the one thing that always eluded her was a man stepping up and saying, I love you and I want to marry you and I'm always going to be with you. So she had two fiancés that flamed out in short order, and she was so broken that by the time Simon, a complete clear grifter that all of her friends and all of her colleagues realized was a dangerous threat and a grifter, she was so attached to him because he said he would marry her in short order after they met, that then that led to her untimely demise. And so I'm at least grateful that Taylor Swift seems to be in a healthier place, definitely a much more self-assured and in control of her career and in control of her lifestyle right now. But Kelsey's a partier, and so it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out, because, I mean, look at what Kelsey's been doing when he's not on these little romantic ice cream dates, walking through parks and zoos with Taylor. He's out with the guys from the football team celebrating, so he's still in the NFL. He's going to have to stay relatively physically fit and healthy for the next couple of years. But then what happens when he's done? NFL players have an interesting track record of their lives and longevity after their careers. So we'll see. Maybe he'll just be the ultimate dad. That's what I'm hoping.
Maybe. Yeah. I think somewhat that what Taylor is asking for is an ideal. I mean, these aren't real people that she's sort of projecting, like, my ideal man would be this. So you could say it in a song, and it evokes all sorts of imagery, like, oh, that would be so great. But then it kind of divorces itself from real life. All the things you just brought up, right? Travis Kelsey's he's a party guy. He likes to hang out with the guys. Okay, would that create a schism in their relationship if he became the ideal guy? It's possible. It's possible. Yeah. So I was going to say that two albums worth of music is a lot to absorb. You were able to do it. I listened to the album once, and then I went to listen to individual tracks a few times, the ones that kind of stood out. But my takeaway, and I guess it's sort of a hot take, obviously it's a hot take since the album hasn't been around for that long, I mean, for public consumption, is, and I'm probably going to piss off some Taylor Swifties, my issue with it is very little tempo variation. Lyrics are good. Some are self-deprecating at times, but it felt plodding to me. Like, I've been on like 31 tracks and they all have roughly the same tempo. There's something that's also lacking in these songs, and something I'm surprised, because Taylor Swift is very good at this. She is a great pop song writer. I don't hear much of that on this record. I don't hear like the out of the gate single where you're like, that is a song. That's a pop song. This thing's got legs. It could be that this album is a grower, but I'm thinking, hey, it's 31 tracks. You think you could have thrown one out of the gate hit single on
there? Put some ringers on there. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And then build around your tortured poet society or dead poet society stuff. She's back to writing to her strengths, which is, of course, the whole confessional songs about how much love hurts and all of that. And I know there are legions of fans out there who love this stuff, and it's not plotting to them in terms of tempo. But to me, the sort of the weepy and the angry quality of the songs, it doesn't have much variation.
They're basically tweets set to music.
Yeah. You know? It's hard to listen to track after track of this.
Yeah. I kind of forgot, as I was preparing for this podcast, as I was going through doing my little rabbit hole on some albums that are celebrating their 40th anniversary this year, I was researching those, forgetting that I had the Taylor Swift record on, because it has very minimalistic music beds, strumming guitar, light little keyboard that could come from a Mac. There's no blistering horn sections or guitar solos or bridges in the instrumentation. Her vocals are up front and center, very minimalist background. And now here's the shocking thing that I noticed. It must have taken an entire 300 people to write the Wikipedia page for this album that fast.
Yeah.
But when you look at the production, there are more than 30 to 50 musicians on this record.
What?
Yeah. And as many, if not more, engineers, mixers, and producers. It's like reading the credits of a blockbuster movie. There's probably more than 150 credits on this record. I compared it just out of curiosity to the first Billie Eilish record. Total credits, musicians and producers and engineers on the first album, 4.
Wow.
Then she became a blockbuster superstar. Total credits, production and musicians on her second album, six.
Jeez.
You know, and so then you look at, you know, and it's the way it's the kind of the same thing with the, if you look at a Beyonce record, every single track will have 54 authors on a track, as well as many producers and everyone else. And so you got to give it to Beyonce and for Taylor Swift for employing a lot of people, keeping that economy going.
Yes, you know? Yes. Yeah, absolutely. But in like, this day and age when it's kind of DIY or very minimal crews that, that work on things, if you're a billionaire, if you're a billionaire like she is, like Taylor is, and or a multimillionaire like Beyonce, why not spread the wealth a little bit, I guess?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think before, as we know, as we wrap up this segment, you need to read to our dear listeners the conspiracy theory that you put together before the video for this, the first song in the album came out. This Post Malone. Yes. So read that, and then we'll talk about the video, and it's going to dovetail to what we've already talked about. And I'm like, oh my God, jaw dropped.
Okay. So you were emailing me and I don't know what got in my head, but I'm responding to you. We're going back and forth on getting this podcast episode together. And I just said, segment one, reaction to the Dead Poets Society album. I know it's the Tortured Poets Department, candidate for the worst album title in 2024. My mind keeps going to that film I never saw in 1989, which is the same year Taylor was born, which has a young Ethan Hawke who was 18, which is the age Taylor was when she wrote Our Song. The word "our" appears 13 times in the film, The Dead Poets Society, all of which were said by Ethan Hawke's character. 13 is Taylor's favorite number. If you take 13 and you add 1989, you get 2002. There are two twos in 2002. And if you look at the teaser video, Taylor posted, the clock says 2 o'clock. That means Ethan Hawke is on the new Taylor Swift album, or fuck, this is exhausting.
But then who shows up in the first video for the album? Ethan Hawke and Josh Charles from Dead Poets Society.
And you said, wow, that's some next level Kennedy Lincoln conspiracy shit you pulled. Yeah. Nicely done.
Oh my God. So, you know, Taylor loves a good Easter egg, and I loved how you put all that together. And sure enough, it did come full circle with Ethan and Josh. And so, but you know, we're not alone. And I kind of caveat this. I was almost going to kick off this segment with legalese saying, we are not going to criticize Taylor Swift in any way. She is our Lord and Savior of pop music, and we respect her because she's perfect and infallible in every single way, much like Queen Beyonce, because look at where Taylor Swift fans are in terms of going after anybody that dare be critical of her. Yeah. But I was glad to see, like, NME magazine called this album a misstep in her, you know, at the height of her career. And several others talked about the same thing. Like, there was one other one that said, the mark of an artist now interested in seeing how much of their empire can atone for the sins of mediocrity. That was from Paste magazine.
Oh, very nice. Wow. That's for Paste. That's okay. All right.
Even the AV Club said, Swift, at this point of her career, has nothing left to prove. And so she's kind of at an uninteresting and stagnant point in her career. So creatively, at least, because you figure, you look at the spectacle that is the 3-hour Eras concert that's on Disney Plus. It's amazing, like the thought and the energy and the just the sequencing that goes into creating a spectacle like that, that she also found time to not only record 31 new tracks for this project, but also then she's also put out 2 more of her re-records in the meantime, you know? And so that's a lot of studio time. I think this feeds the beast. It keeps her content relevant. You know, she'll have a couple of weeks at the top in our zeitgeist before Dua Lipa comes out May 3rd. And then 2 weeks after that, we've got new Billie Eilish. And so it's going to be interesting to see how these albums all play out through the rest of the year. But even as we say on a future episode of this podcast, we're going to talk about all the other big, huge, amazing blockbuster records that came out this week, last week, and next week. There's going to be a lot to talk about. So
plenty, plenty. And I don't want to leave it by saying that none of it stood out to me. I was thinking about some of the standout tracks. And interestingly enough, the one that stood out the most was the final track called The Manuscript. I thought that well, this is really a pretty powerful song. I really like the way it's very simple. Like you said, most of her songs are fairly simple. There's not a lot of orchestration, even despite the fact that tons of people worked on this record. The title track, the really funny line, "We're modern idiots." I thought, well, that's kind of That's pretty cool. I like that, that she's kind of self-deprecating like that. The song Florida with Florence and the Machine, yeah, also quite good.
Black Dog was my favorite because it kind of
Black Dog, you really like that one. Okay.
Yeah, and kind of comes on a little bit stronger than the rest. And so I'm like, oh, that was a refreshing change of pace.
All right.
You know, so I think there's some
interesting ones. Kind of stand up to you? Did you like the manuscript, the final track?
No, I really liked the manuscript. I liked the Bolter, which is the one that is attached to my deluxe edition. So I was kind of a little bit more invested in that one.
Okay.
And so I think there's some interesting ones. Amy, that has to be about Kim Kardashian. I'm like, I try to live my life without anything Kim Kardashian in it. Right. So,
you know, the interesting thing is the single Fortnite is to me not a very good single. I thought that's the first single off the record. Okay. Well, I mean, maybe it'll grow on me.
You know, because the thing is, I'm not a big Post Malone fan. And I'm like, they actually make Post Malone kind of tolerable. So there's something.
Yeah. And I was talking with my daughter on the way. We had a dentist appointment, believe it or not, on the way there. And she says, well, what did you think of the Taylor album? And I said, I'm going to kind of piss you off a little bit, but I thought it was a bit of a snoozer at times. She goes, really? I said, but you know what, honey? This album wasn't made for me. I'm a casual fan. I like some of her songs, but I don't read too much into her records. I don't listen to full albums by her. I said, this album was made for you. She goes, what do you mean me? I said, you're the super fan. I said, she's writing lyrics and songs that appeal to you. She doesn't have to write the big mass appeal hit. She's already done all that. She's re-recorded all her most successful records, not all of them, but almost all of them. And so I think at this point in her career, she can release 31 tracks of music that for my ears, I'm like, it's all right. I don't see what the big deal is. But for somebody like you, who's really into her, you're like, no, this is really good. Like some of these lyrics really kind of tell the story of what she's gone through with these relationships. And that's important too.
It's a very immersive experience. Yeah.
For super fans like, you know, Will Harris's daughter, my daughter, you're a super fan, but you're one of the super fans that I see as somebody who can also step away and say, well, hold on a minute. Yeah, I'll buy everything, but I'm still kind of a music critic at heart. So I hear when I know a good song, I know a good song. And you can step back from it. But yeah, I know that you're a super fan of Taylor.
And I'm going to end with a note of admiration because I was always curious to kind of dovetail because I have her debut album with the hologram cover. That was a Best Buy exclusive, I think. And you have to hand it to her, at the age of 11, that girl was hustling her music. They recorded some demos, some cover songs. She went around and they got a bunch of meetings in Nashville, got rejected across the board. You know, they basically said, most country western fans are middle-aged. They are not going to care about the musings of a teenage girl. It made me think of when Clive Davis first signed Gwen Stefani and No Doubt, he said, you are going to be the biggest star in the world, .. in 5 years.
Oh, wow.
Meaning you need to develop your skills before I put you out there.
Mm-hmm.
But Taylor Swift was like, no, I want my debut album to reflect my teenage experience. And so she kept hustling. She switched from recording demos and covers to original music. That got her the development deal that then led her to the Big Machine contract. And she was able to put down this first record while she was in her first year of high school. You know, so you got to hand that hustle to her just to get her foot in the door. And then, as they say, the rest is history. And that debut album was a blockbuster and spent just countless weeks on the top 200. I think it set some records. She's definitely well-deserved with all the success that she's had. I don't deify her. I don't think that she's infallible, but I really do respect her game. So that's what I want to leave it on.
Yes, she's talented. She's good at writing the kind of songs that have made her popular. And again, I'm not sure it's going to matter one bit what my opinion of her music is. She's one of those unique artists. I think she just kind of comes along from time to time, who has this kind of star power that's hard to explain, but it's easy to understand. You just got to watch one of her concerts or listen to some of her more popular songs, listen to her music that made her popular, and you'll get it. You'll say, okay, maybe it's not for me, but I get it. Yes. And she does have star power. So
just watch this time next week. The nation will be in mourning because two Gen X podcasters were kind of indifferent on the album.
And both died in a fiery death in their scions.
Exactly.
It's very suspicious.
Two scions blew up in the same week.
So are we closing the door on the tortured poets department? Can we just like close it for now? Like a little
there bit? You go. And thank you, Ethan Hawke, for all that you do.
Thank you, Ethan. That's it. That's a wrap. That's the episode. We'll be back soon right here on the Planet LP Podcast.